Everyone. Today we have two bills on our agenda. Senate Bill 106 is the first one, and we will open a public hearing at this time on Senate Bill 106. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 106 is here to before you to require firefighters and emergency medical technicians to report the abuse of elderly persons. It additionally modifies the definition of abuse for elderly persons and persons with disabilities by adding to that a few different financial, it expands the definition to include wrongful taking or appropriation of finances. It also adds non-consenting sexual contact to that. Additionally, it establishes rules governing the passage of property from elderly and incapacitated persons who suffer physical or financial abuse that results in the felony conviction of the abuser. It provides that if that abused person dies within 5 years after the occurrence of the abuse, property that would have passed from the abused person to the abuser by either intestate succession, will, or trust would pass as if the abuser had predeceased the abused person.
Thank you very much. We will start our hearing today with Erin Kelly Seal and Joyce Demonen. Demonen, please correct me on this pronunciation. The committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name for the record is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the Governor's Policy Advisor on Health and Human Services. With me is Joyce Demonen, a victims advocate who started the Elder Safe program several years ago, and I'll let her tell you more about that in just a minute. My role here today is to give you a high-level overview of Senate Bill 106 and the problem that it seeks to address. As part of his comprehensive public safety review, the governor last February created an interim elder abuse task force. And last October, that task force issued a report that you all now have a copy of that contains a series of recommendations around some comprehensive actions designed to strengthen protections for Oregon's older citizens. One of the recommendations, it's actually on the last page, was that our office work with you all, the 73rd Legislative Assembly, on a series of statutory changes designed to provide additional protection for vulnerable adults who have been victims of financial exploitation, theft, physical, and sexual abuse. That recommendation led to the drafting of Senate Bill 106 that attempts, as you heard from counsel, to do four major things. First, it expands the definition of abuse in the Elderly and Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Abuse Prevention Act to include financial and sexual abuse. The Elderly and Persons with Disabilities Prevention Act, which is codified in ORS Chapter 124, creates a civil remedy in the form of a restraining order for seniors and persons with disabilities who can show that they've been the victim of abuse within the preceding 180 days and that there's an immediate and present danger of further abuse from the abuser. Until now, the type of abuse for which a restraining order could be sought was limited to physical abuse, neglect that leads to physical harm, abandonment, or exploitation by a sweepstakes promotion at a certain financial level. Senate Bill 106 would expand the types of abuse for which a restraining order could be sought to include the wrongful taking or appropriating of money or property, threatening to wrongfully take or appropriate money or property, and non-consensual sexual conduct. Unfortunately, financial abuse of the elderly is a growing problem in Oregon. As people grow older, they may become more dependent on others for care, including having to have someone help them with their finances. Unfortunately, sometimes that help turns into financial exploitation. The following examples were part of a Department of Human Services newsletter recently, and I thought I'd just give you a couple. A client in Crook County was financially exploited for $10,000 by a neighbor who was picking up her mail on a regular basis. The alleged perpetrator does not have the means to repay the money, and the client had to turn to Medicaid sooner because of this. In another case, a 91-year-old Oregonian never knew he had an ATM card until he didn't have enough money to pay his bills. His daughter had used a power of attorney to establish a card on his account and used his money to shop for herself. In the last example, an 84-year-old Oregonian was being charged $500 for each trip she made to the grocery store, a total of 19 miles. by the caregiver who was transporting her. These are just a couple of examples that demonstrate the need for the type of protection that's included in 106 in the restraining order as a civil remedy. In 2003, Oregon data shows there were 2,072 allegations of financial abuse, like the ones I've just described. This is almost 26% of all the reports of abuse and neglect about seniors and people with disabilities the department receives. And unfortunately, this type of abuse is often perpetrated by someone the person knows, a family member, a friend, or a neighbor. As the baby boomer generation ages, this problem is expected to worsen. And as I said, Senate Bill 106 is an attempt to address the growing problem by enhancing protection available to seniors and people with disabilities and empowering them to prevent further abuse. The second thing the bill does is expand the list of public and private officials mandated to report elder abuse to include firefighters and emergency medical technicians, responders who frequently come into contact with seniors. It also provides immunity to all individuals who report elder abuse in good faith. Until now, the provisions in ORS Chapter 124 dealing with the reporting of abuse of elderly persons could have been interpreted to limit that immunity only to mandatory reporters. And 106 is an attempt to assure that any person reporting in good faith is immune from civil liability. Lastly, 106 also attempts to enhance protection for older Oregonians and incapacitated persons who've been the victim of financial, physical, or sexual abuse by establishing rules governing the passage of property from those individuals to an abuser who might otherwise benefit from that abuse through intestate succession, will, or trust. The last thing I want to do is mention to the committee that we would really appreciate the opportunity to work with staff on a couple of amendments that we've been in conversation with stakeholders about since the bill itself was posted for hearing. The first has to do with the definition of a person with disability in ORS 124. 005 sub 8. We need to change the definition to eliminate a technical flaw that we found after the bill was drafted that provides that a person that defines a person with disabilities in part by an income-related means test. We have some draft language using a proposed rule that the Department of Human Services Adult Protective Services Unit actually has proposed, and we think it'll work. We also think it may address some concerns that we understand were raised last week in the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law regarding House Bill 2415, a bill that extends to persons with disabilities the right to bring a civil action for financial or physical abuse. The second proposed amendment is designed to reduce the fiscal impact perceived by the Judicial Department, and we've been working with them on some language narrowing the scope of relief to be granted when financial abuse is at issue in a petition for a restraining order. As I said, we'd be more than happy and appreciate the opportunity to work with Ledge Counsel and your staff around some of the language to address each of those issues. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to let the committee know that the issue of elder abuse is very personal to the governor himself, not just because of his long history, which began when he was insurance commissioner, continued under his tenure as attorney general, and is now something he prioritizes as governor, but also because he and his wife, Mary Oberst, have recently taken on primary responsibility for Mary's mother, who moved here recently from Kentucky. She is in her 90s and is showing signs of Alzheimer's, and so both Ted and Mary have been, I think this issue has become even more relevant for both of them as that personal experience has touched their lives. So, again, I just very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of this legislation. I welcome questions, and I'd also like to turn it over to Joyce, who's going to expand a little bit on what I've said.
Thank you. Are there questions before we move to the next decision? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Joyce Damanin from Washington County. I think I bring the experience from the field, at least one county, and can give you some examples of what we see every day in the community. And I provided a copy of my testimony for you. CW 84 was financially exploited and ultimately assaulted by her daughter's drug-dealing boyfriend. DF 84 has a great nephew who routinely burgles her house, steals her valuables, and pawns them. BW 87 was kidnapped and robbed by a man she knew who had been rehabilitated for methamphetamine, but then he decided he needed a fix, a developmentally disabled man, WC 83, was conned out of more than $500,000 by a former grocery clerk who befriended him. Criminal justice professionals and adult protective service workers worked nearly 2 years to unravel this case and to bring the woman to justice. These cases are from Washington County, but similar anecdotes and problems are happening all across the state for people 65 and older. I coordinate Elder Safe in Washington County, a victims assistance program for people 65 and older and people with disabilities. In the past 5 years, my volunteers, staff, and I have assisted more than 2,000 people in this age group alone. Stories like the ones I highlighted are happening across our state, and that is one of the reasons why Governor Kulongoski convened the Elder Abuse Task Force a year ago. This far-reaching provision of Senate Bill 106 provides new safeguards for elders and people with disabilities, refines the law, and would preclude elder abuser from inheriting from his or her victim. I had the opportunity to work on the task force last year with 18 other professionals from across the state who have expertise in elder abuse. We took testimony on various aspects of elder abuse, from sexual assault to financial exploitation. As Erin mentioned, the task force came up with many far-reaching proposals, including gubernatorial orders, public-private partnerships, and a series of legislative concepts, which were turned into SB 106. The task force worked to find cost-effective solutions with minimal fiscal impact while maximizing protection for Oregon's vulnerable adults.
Ms. Damano?
Yes.
Excuse me if I could interrupt. We have your testimony in front of us. Would it be possible to kind of summarize what's in here for us? Because we have a fair number of people signed up and want to make sure we get to everybody.
All right.
Thank you.
I would just like to highlight a couple of anecdotes for you that are included in my testimony, because I think a lot of people don't really understand some of the breadth and depth of the issue. I would just bring one up. For example, in Washington County a year and a half ago, a woman who had Alzheimer's and was in an adult foster care home and was sexually assaulted by her caregiver's husband. Since she had Alzheimer's, by the time APS came back and was getting testimony from her, she had already forgotten the incident, and the incident was dropped. A year later, a woman with a stroke was also sexually assaulted by the same caregiver. And because he had mistaken her ability to tell her story to law enforcement, he was successfully prosecuted. One of the things we're really concerned about is sexual assault being included in this provision of the definition for elder abuse, because it is something we feel is the most underreported type of elder abuse in Oregon. Of course, financial exploitation is the thing that we see the most of every day, as Erin mentioned also. It is something that takes resources from the community, from law enforcement, adult protective services, social workers, families. And one of the things that we're so concerned about, too, is that as people lose all of their life savings, they cannot go back to work and re-earn that money, and they will become more and more dependent on government resources to not live in dire poverty. My work for the past 5 years has been strictly in elder abuse, and we have seen many, many people die shortly thereafter. In fact, as I mentioned in my testimony, there is actual research evidence that elder abuse victims have a higher mortality rate than all other victims combined. As anyone can tell you who works in elder abuse, these victims often live in quiet despair. I look outside today and see the hundreds of advocates out here for education, and I know that if our seniors had the same kind of health and fitness, they would be here in support of this bill. Unfortunately, it is left to us, those who advocate for them, to be here on their behalf and to speak up for the thousands of people that we deal with, and I appreciate your attention to this. And I also included in the packet a case study that I wrote for victimization of the elderly and disabled that was published last year, which is a really good case example of how a family member can use a power of attorney and a trust in an older person to gain control over an elder's assets. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is excellent testimony. I really appreciate your coming today. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Byers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The section of the bill, section 4 on, does that also deal with the disabled, or is that strictly elderly? and that's when we talked about the mandatory reporting, and then if you die within 5 years, if the victim dies within 5 years, if the perpetrator is can't inherit.
I actually did a bit of a cross-section review myself to try to discern which pieces of the bill related to which sections of Chapter 124 and 112. Pete Shepard is here from the Department of Justice, so he can hopefully correct me if I'm wrong, but there are several major sections that are amended. Your question, Senator Chair Burdick, is to Senator Byer's question. I believe Section 4 relates to the provisions that have to do with reporting of abuse of elderly persons. And so that's Chapter 124, 050 through 095. And then with respect to the property, the provisions of the bill, which I believe begin on Section 6 through the end of the bill with respect to the rules that apply to property, those sections apply to civil actions for abuse of elderly or incapacitated persons, so they add another dimension and definition of an incapacitated person, which is cross-referenced in another section. I don't know if that clarified, but the first section of the bill, which is 124.005 through 040, does deal with elderly persons and persons with disabilities, the Abuse Prevention Act. And then there's the reporting of elderly persons, and then the section with respect to wills, trust, and intestate succession has to do with elderly persons and incapacitated persons. So different categories for each section.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. Another question?
Follow-up.
You testified that you are working to narrow the definition or working on the definition of disabled persons right now, and I appreciate that because I was there at the hearing last week with the House and they had quite a conversation about that. So I guess hopefully you'll come up with a definition, and I don't know what the definition of the, would you say it's elderly and what in the Section 6 through incapacitated persons?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, there is the bill I think you're referring to is House Bill 2416, which would relate to the section in 106 that does deal with intestate succession and wills. And there's a proposal on the House side to add not just to allow that section not just to apply to the elderly or incapacitated people, but to expand it to include persons with disabilities. And my understanding is that the House Subcommittee on Judiciary had some conversation along the lines of the definition, which actually refers back to the first section dealt with in Senate Bill 106, Chapter 124.005, and refers back to the definition of persons with disabilities in that section of the statute. And when my understanding is there was a concern that that definition was overly broad, and that was raised in committee. I did mention that we do have a proposed amendment that was intended to address a different issue, actually the issue relating to the fact that there is currently a means test attached to the definition of persons with disabilities in Chapter 124.005, and this section was never intended to apply just to low-income people with disabilities. It was intended to apply to all people with disabilities, and so we had worked on some draft language for you to consider that would have addressed that issue. But in looking back at that draft language, I think it also addresses the issue that Senator Byer and that the House Subcommittee on House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law was working to address with House Bill 2416.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you. Another cross-reference here in personal disability is an ORS 410715. It's line 17 on page 2 of the bill. And that statute is declaring it people with brain injuries. The Senate passed a bill a week or so back dealing with traumatic brain injuries, and I was wondering if that bill amended the same section that would include or increase the amount of people who would qualify under this brain injury statute.
That's a very good question. Do you know the answer?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, I'm sorry I do not, but I'd be happy to follow up on that for you.
That would be useful. Thank you. Any more? Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. I'm kind of getting ahead of somebody who's going to be testifying later, but by making mandatory reporting apply to not just the physical condition of a person, but the financial, possible financial abuse. Some of these people are, who are mandatory reporters, are not really trained to see financial abuse. Did you discuss that issue at all in your task force, and do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think the intent of the task force was not for a mandatory reporter to investigate something, but when it's something is blatantly obvious that it's happening, that they are required to report it. And I think people who are working with seniors see this all the time, where, you know, family members might be misusing the power of attorney or just helping themselves to things at that point. We want to know what's going on. I don't think it's the requirement. We do, for most mandatory reporters, have training, but it's not mandated training, so it's available to people if they want it.
How is it available?
Well, Adult Protective Services is in every community in Oregon, and they do a lot of work with their community partners all the time on training law enforcement, medical people. That's fairly routine as part of their community work, as partnerships. We have multidisciplinary teams in every community, and most of our mandatory reporters are members of our team, and they provide information and sharing at those meetings. We also are planning to have a statewide elder abuse conference in September.
Thank you. But if someone is like a paramedic or somebody comes in, and whether they've had the training or not, if they feel that somebody is being financially exploited and they're just dead wrong about it, then the immunity provision would protect them from
absolutely. Yeah, I think we would rather err on the side of annoying people reporting suspected abuse. This happens in the community now with people suspecting abuse. It may or not be valid, but that's one of the roles that APS plays in our community, is being able to go into a situation and assess that.
Okay. Thank you for that expounding on there. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, next I think we'll take Pete Shepherd and Morgan Brody. Welcome. Maybe you could go first, Pete, since some of the questions seem to fall into your bailiwick.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'll simply, in view of the lengthy list of folks who are going to talk to you about this bill today, I'll be very brief. The Attorney General's Elder Abuse Task Force members have discussed this bill, and while the task force itself doesn't, we don't ask members to collectively endorse legislation, I think it's fair to say that all of the participants in that very broad-based group are in support of the conceptual presentation set out in Senate Bill 106. Attorney General Hardy Myers supports the bill and appreciates the opportunity to work with your staff on amendments that would improve a couple of the aspects of it. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think the legal analysis that Ms. Kelly Seal gave you was just right on. It tracked my understanding of the different effects of the three parts of the bill, and I think it does have the different applications that she described there. Let me say just a word about the nature of the immunity for the reporters. A reporter who erroneously reports a suspicion that a person has been the victim of financial abuse or any other form of abuse does enjoy immunity under current law for that report, provided the report was made in good faith. And so it would extend quite broadly to a person who erroneously suspected some form of financial abuse.
If I just interrupt you on that point, conversely, if they're not trained and they miss the financial abuse, can someone come back after them later and say, you should have known?
Madam Chair, I'll let Ms. Brody testify to the reporting experience to date. I I think it's correct to say that we're not aware of any circumstance in to date in which there has been any application of any sanction for failure to report under these statutes. The statutory remedy, as I understand it, is a $500 civil penalty, which is not very fully spelled out in the applicable statutes, so it appears to be something that a district attorney would have to seek in a judicial proceeding. But perhaps when Ms. Brody testifies, she can tell you about Adult Protective Services' experience in that regard. But I think it's correct to say that there has not been an application of that penalty provision anywhere to date under the existing reporting statutes.
Thank you. We'll wait for the testimony.
And, Madam Chair, with that, I don't have anything further to add, and I'd stand by for questions.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Did you have your other question answered?
I think so, yeah.
Sufficiently? Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Brody?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us the time. My name is Morgan Brody, and I'm an Adult Protective Service Program Coordinator with Seniors and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services. We are in support of this bill, and I have handed out some testimony. First, if I could answer your question, Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge in researching this, there is, as Mr. Shepherd pointed out, a $500 penalty for failure to report for mandatory reporters, and in the I think 13 or 14 years that I've been doing this work, I have not been able to find a single case in which that has been applied in cases of adult abuse. It has in some child abuse cases. The national research that we have looked at indicates that the most expeditious way to get people to report is not the punishment for failure to report, but the extension of civil and criminal immunity where people do report with good cause and in good faith, as this bill would provide. My job before you this afternoon, and again I'll be brief in respect to your time, is just to give a little background information on the issues of financial abuse and sexual abuse as they would apply in this bill. As Aaron and Joyce pointed out to you, financial abuse is the largest category of perpetrator-committed abuse that we see in Adult Protective Services and does comprise about 26% of our cases. Typically what we're seeing are people who are both family members and friends and caregivers and increasingly predatory strangers who become the new best friend of a vulnerable adult, doing things such as misusing powers of attorney, forging documents, committing identity theft, and using undue influence as a means of manipulating and exploiting people. And we have finally developed some models nationally to look at. Dr. Bennett Blum is one of the national experts who talks about undue influence, which is a process by which a stranger will introduce themselves into the lives of a vulnerable adult, truly isolate them and create a dependence upon the stranger, emotionally manipulate that person. Typically, we'll see cases where this exploiter will move into the home, will turn away visitors, will turn away phone calls, at the same time telling the victim, look, no one else cares about you, no one else is calling, no one else is coming to visit but me, and eventually create such a dependence that the victim will acquiesce and will sign over powers of attorney or joint tenancy agreements based on the kind of emotional, intense isolation and manipulation and sustains a loss. We used to have a fairly difficult time making those cases, if you will, and now our companions in law enforcement and our workers in Adult Protective Services are much more adept at that. What we're also seeing is the wide-ranging impact on the victims. It's not just a matter of financial loss, and as Joyce pointed out, many of the people that we work with don't have an opportunity to re-earn the nest egg that is lost to a perpetrator, but people often who exploit elders financially also engage in physical abuse, in some cases sexual abuse, almost certainly verbal and emotional abuse, sometimes neglect to the point of death, and we have seen nationally some cases of outright homicide when the victim is either married to the perpetrator or the perpetrator stands to gain if the victim dies. The victim is killed. In other cases, people are so embarrassed and so ashamed at having been hoodwinked by perpetrators that they have committed suicide. So it's really a matter of life and death, literally, in some of these cases. having the restraining order capability will help us have law enforcement and adult protective service workers be able to turn away perpetrators simply for recontacting the victim and perhaps save lives again. Sex abuse, as Joyce and Erin indicated, is really the lowest statistical number that we see. And we think that nationally that's just because we haven't been alert to the signs and symptoms. We haven't asked the right questions. As our technology has developed in this field, we're seeing increasing numbers of victims. Again, sadly, the perpetrators are the very people that a vulnerable adult should be able to trust, their family, their friends, their caregivers, the people who should be providing support for them. We are seeing that not only are people who are vulnerable adults as a result of disability or age statistically dramatically more likely to be sexually abused by perpetrators, they are also statistically likely to suffer much more egregious injuries, more physical injuries, more psychological injuries, and in fact are 3 times more likely to die in the next 10 years than people who have not been abused. The sexual perpetrators are looking for people who are vulnerable against whom to offend, and particularly victims who are cognitively impaired or have a communicative disorder, so they're not able to testify, they're not able to remember what happened, are, I hate to say, but from a perpetrator's point of view, very attractive victims. They're perfect victims. And our work is to recognize, again, the behavioral signs that people are able to give us, the communication that people are able to share with us to respond to that. And so having the strength in this bill to add both sexual and financial abuse really will strengthen our ability to serve these people. That's in a nutshell what I'd like to share with you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Next we'll take Kamala Sugar, Bertrand Kopp, and Dolores Hubert. Welcome. We'll start with you.
Thank you. My name is Kamala Sugar. I'm from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'm a deputy DA in Lane County, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. The District Attorneys Association is in support of Senate Bill 106. I would echo many of the anecdotes that you've already heard, and I'm not going to give you more anecdotes. I think you're probably pretty convinced at this point that it's a problem. I would tell you that I wanted to point out the bill regarding the financial abuse includes threats to wrongfully take money, and anecdotally I can tell you that that is something that actually happens quite frequently, either by threats of force, if you don't give me the money I will hurt you, or I'm going to take this money so do this other thing for me, like sign over power of attorney or put me in your will or things like that. That said, I also support the mandatory reporting opportunity because it does provide exemption from civil liability for reports made in good faith, and I think that's a very important feature. So unless you have questions for myself on behalf of the District Attorneys Association, I have no other comments.
Thank you for coming. Questions? Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Bertrand Kopp. I'm a senior advocate. I've been at this for over 10 years, and I'm very, very glad to see that so much effort is being spent in this field. My big problem with this bill is I can hear lawyers arguing when they read line 27 on page 1, the definition of wrongfully. Who's decide what's wrongfully and what's rightfully? I've been advised by other people that such clauses should be written as a cause. And I might suggest that it be worded to say to cause physical or emotional harm by taking or appropriating money or property, or threatening to take or appropriate money or property, just to identify what the effect is. I can't see any way but doing it that way. Then the second thing on page 3, line 25 through 27, somebody is being refused the opportunity to defend themselves. I don't agree with that one at all. Everybody should have a right to defend themselves, regardless of the reasons they happen to be under somebody else's care. I would suggest that it should be reworded to say when an elderly person or a person with disabilities who files a petition under ORS 125, ending the sentence with shall be caused to re-examine the validity of the case. Because no one should be forbidden the right to defend themselves. That's the thing that bothers me about that.
Thank you. Is that it?
That's my comments.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dolores Hubert. I chair the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I'm a retired nurse from Northeast Portland. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of 106. I think it's an excellent bill. The Governor's Commission on Senior Services has made improving Oregon's ability to respond to abuse one of its top priorities for this particular biennium. Last week, the Governor's Commission, along with the Governor, was very pleased. We joined forces with many of our coalition on senior financial abuse, and we had the Senior Boomer Fair, which was a very, very successful operation at the fairgrounds. Financial abuse, as you know, is the number one abuse against seniors in Oregon at this present time. This legislative session, you'll likely be hearing many bills designed to combat abuse in many forms. The Commission has developed a set of five components which comprise our platform on abuse legislation. Number one, Oregon must provide immunity, protection for all reporters of abuse. Number two, financial and sexual abuse must be included in the definition of abuse under the law, a very important change. And abusers must not be able to benefit from the death of a person that they have abused. Number four, the pool of mandatory reporters should be expanded to include firefighters and emergency medical technicians. But most importantly, law enforcement must have the tools to be able to prosecute the abusers. Senate Bill 106 was the product of long and thoughtful deliberation. It includes many of the provisions that the Governor's Commission on Senior Services platform on abuse is part of, and we are pleased, very pleased, to endorse the bill. We strongly encourage your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or get you any information that you might need.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Okay. Next we'll have Rick Bennett and Tim Marble. Bob Livingston, why don't you come on up too? Get all three of them here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, representing AARP Oregon. I've provided a letter from our state director, Jerry Cohen. Mr. Cohen served as a member on the governor's Elder Abuse Task Force. Also participates on the Attorney General's Task Force on Elder Abuse as well. I'll be very brief. We support the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force, including the statutory changes recommended in Senate Bill 106. And I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Timothy Marble. I'm an attorney in private practice in Western Washington County in the community of Forest Grove. I practice primarily in the area of wills, trust estates, probates, guardianships, and conservatorships. I'm very familiar with ORS Chapter 124 and 125, as well as the probate statutes, probate code. Those are the tools in my trade. I use them every day. I'm testifying here today on behalf of and in favor of Senate Bill 106, in part because I helped draft it and because I've hammered out some of the hard-fought details with the Governor's Task Force, of which I was a member, and also the Attorney General's Task Force on Elder Abuse. I've handed out a written testimony. I'm just going to briefly summarize it. A case came across my desk couple of years ago involving a perpetrator by the name of Roxanna Thomas. Roxanna Thomas, within a matter of about 6 months, stole about $200,000 from an elderly gentleman who had diminished capacity. She stood to inherit another $300,000 from him. She was getting ready to take him on a trip to Florida. We were able to go in with an emergency guardianship and conservatorship and stop her from doing that. And this is a success story. We recovered most of the money, and she's actually in prison right now as a result of her conduct. The last exhibit on my testimony is a will in which the victim gives her all of his estate. Unfortunately, because of the way the laws are drafted currently, that will is a valid document. We were successfully able in the civil settlement to get her to prospectively waive her right to inherit, but that's kind of an untried thing. We don't know how that's going to work out yet. The will is a valid will. She's in prison for taking all this guy's money, and yet there's still a will that is valid and could be she could potentially claim it on. About 5 years ago, I made a comment to Judge Pro Tem Rita Cobb in Chambers about, you know, why isn't there a law that keeps abusers from inheriting? Everybody I've ever talked to asks the same question. They think, well, isn't that a law? Why isn't that a law? It should be a law, and it's really a no-brainer to get this passed. The other bill I'd like to talk about, or it's the same bill, but we also talked about the idea of a financial abuse restraining order. This case actually would have been a really good case to use a restraining order because there was clear evidence of financial abuse. We were actually able to get a restraining order using the guardianship and conservatorship statutes, but that was only because there was about 100 hours of police investigative work. It's a rare case where we have the cooperation of various private agencies and public agencies in order to get the kind of evidence that it takes to get a restraining order in a case where there's financial abuse. The proposal you have before you would streamline that process and enable people who have limited resources in order to be able to get the kind of protection they need immediately in order to protect them. I've had concerns about the idea of a financial abuse restraining order because of the potential that it could step on the toes of the protective proceeding statutes under RRS 125. I've been working with Pete Shepard and Joyce DeMonnen and others to try to hammer out the concerns that I had, concerns that had been expressed to me by members of the judiciary, in order to try to figure out, well, how can we craft this so that it dovetails with the current guardianship and conservatorship statutes and yet gets the job done. I believe that we have done that successfully in the language that you have before you and that Pete and I have worked on. We'll get the job done. I practice in this area quite a bit. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. You said that you drafted this bill. You were the drafter on this bill?
The portion that relates to it modifies the Slayer law, yes.
Oh, okay.
Not the whole thing. No, absolutely not. Its counterpart is House Bill 2415, which is really kind of the part that I worked on primarily. And I had a lot of help with it, too. I didn't do it myself.
Okay, so I did have a question, and actually I'll just run it by you just to see if you want to comment, because I can ask Ms. Kelly Seal and Mr. Shepard to come up if necessary. But Mr. Kopp raised the issue on page 3 where an elderly person or a person with disabilities may not file a petition under ORS 124.005 to 124.040. Those are actually the abuse provisions, and I was kind of wondering why that was phrased the way it was. Do you want to comment on that, or should I ask them?
Well, I'd be happy to comment on that. I don't have the SB 106 in front of me. I didn't have a lot of time to
prepare.
Oh, okay.
Never mind. We won't put you on the spot here. We'll wait on that.
I think I know what the question is. Your question is, why is it the part that has to do with the Slayer law, or is it part with the financial, why there's a limitation on guardians?
Yeah, it's a limitation on filing a petition under the parts that pertain. Oh, I see it. Yeah,
actually,
it is the property. Yeah, it is the property and sexual contact.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I actually did draft that language, that particular language, and that was included as a result of some concerns I had, because Right now, if you didn't limit the ability to bring a restraining order against guardians and conservators, you'd have a real chaos in courts, because if a third party could bring a restraining order against a court-appointed guardian and conservator, then you'd be essentially usurping the jurisdiction of the probate courts to be overseeing the guardianship and conservatorship process.
But this doesn't refer to a third party. This refers to the elderly person or a person with disabilities themselves not being able to file a petition. Why don't we hold up on this question and bring the others back after we hear the next testimony?
Sure.
We can get to the bottom of this.
Thank you.
Other questions of this witness? Senator Pozanski.
Since you, Mr. Marble, participated in some of the drafting, I wonder if there was any conversation as to why there isn't an emergency clause with this bill. It seems to me that we'd want to have this in effect immediately, as quick upon signage, knowing that Section 18 distinguishes certain areas that will be retroactive and post signature, where others isn't. It just seems to me that we've got cases that, where if we got these type of wills that are sitting out there that could be executed upon at any time, it would seem to me that it would be good public policy to move this forward as quickly as we can.
Yeah, I certainly would have no objections to that.
Was there any discussion as to
why? There really wasn't, except for, I guess, I don't recall any particular discussion why it wasn't made to go into effect on an emergency basis.
Thank you.
Thank you for raising that, Senator Pozanski. Senator Whitsitt.
Chip Burdick, Mr. Marble. Just to follow up on a question the chair asked a while ago, and I didn't hear a concise answer. What is the liability for failure to report in good faith? And is there a specific immunity in this bill for good faith failure to report? You just didn't know.
I'm not as familiar with that aspect of the bill as someone else might be, but I don't. It's my understanding that. And I've never come across a case where there's...
Before we get to Senator Whitsitt, we're going to be calling Pete Shepard back from the Attorney General's office, and I think that question is perfect for him. So we'll get you off the hook on that for
Thank
the
you.
Moment. Are there other questions? Okay.
May I make one final comment?
Oh,
there was a comment about the definition of wrongfully, and I have researched that issue because I've actually had to brief that in court, and there is a pretty clear definition understanding what wrongfully means by case law in case there's any concerns about that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Livingston.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston and I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I want to make it perfectly clear to the committee members and for the folks that are sitting behind me that on concept, the firefighters absolutely support any public policy that is going to enhance or broaden the protection that we want to do to our aging population here in Oregon. As not only the lobbyist for the firefighters, I am a firefighter, and anecdotally I can provide to you that in just a generality, firefighters are always willing to look out for seniors, and even in instances where there may not be issues that rise to the level of elder abuse, I can't count the number of times that we've worked with, whether it's the home health nurses or adult protective services, in any inclination of where we think there may be suspect of abuse, or even not just necessarily abuse, but simply a senior citizen that's living at home and having a difficult time really providing for themselves. I think we've worked well with that. Having said that, and making it perfectly clear that we support doing whatever we can from a public policy to protect our seniors, we do have some questions with respect to this particular bill. The first one is that I do note that one of your speakers said that there is training available. In my experience, though, however, there is roughly 900, I believe, local employers that employ a cadre of police officers and firefighters. And so one of the things that we would like to do, if there's going to be additional things and if awareness is one of the problems that we want to try to cure here, we really need to have those mandatory reporters have more training. And as I've listened to some of the testimony, clearly there's some real sophisticated issues, and some of those, Madam Chair, you've already brought up, such as the financial ability, and I understand that there's immunity for this if you do it in good faith, but one of the questions that I would have, as I think you will work other bills, there's going to be some bills that also would address the issue of failure to act, that we would certainly have some concern, because first and foremost, I think we would all agree, we want to make sure that we protect our citizens. But if I, as a firefighter, and my fellow firefighters and paramedics do not have the appropriate level of training or the proper amount of training from experts, really we're not serving our seniors and Oregonians very well. And so we would just have some issues and concerns on, let's make sure that if we pass this piece of legislation that we're reaching out, and the people that really need the training, we're making sure that they receive that. And then the other question that I have, and I don't ask this to certainly blow up the bill or do anything like that, but it's a question that I would have concerns with. As we spoke about some of these people that are particularly sophisticated with financial, you know, doing things and siphoning monies off from accounts and trustees, whether it happens to be a family member or somebody that's a provider, and it's a rhetorical question, but by adding firefighters and paramedics who would respond to a situation on an emergency medical issue or one of those cares, are we actually enabling somebody that's going to take advantage of our seniors by making them a mandatory reporter, and then they're not going to call those folks in the first place and at least get them the care? And I don't say that to try to kill the bill. I'm just trying to make sure that we protect our citizens, because like I've noted before, there's many instances where we've at least intervened and tried to assist these people. And so these are some of the questions that I have. And we really appreciate all of the hard work of the people that have done this on the Governor's Elder Abuse Task Force, but we want to make sure that we take a good bill in concept and make sure we do everything we can in our power to make it better. And with that, I'd take any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I didn't hear all of your testimony, Mr. Livingston, but we did talk earlier today. I have a bill in this committee that would increase the penalties, both financially and jail time, for failure to report by a mandatory reporter. And I've been communicating with a judge who wants me to go beyond that in terms of requiring training for mandatory reporters. And that's sort of the question that you're addressing here. And I guess I want to ask you, most professional people have continuing education credits they have to get. I mean, they may call them professional development credits or something like that. So it seems to me that it's very easy to put in a half hour or 1 hour training on how to report child abuse, sex abuse, elder abuse, for all the mandatory reporters. Wouldn't you think that would be reasonable?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely I would agree with that, but certainly, and I think there's representatives from the fire chiefs and the fire districts here, there's lots of mandatory training that is required, and certainly this is as important as any of those, but as you start going through the long list of required training and all that, it starts to add up considerably on training time and all that, and finding the balance between making sure you keep employees in service to respond to emergencies and all that, and we agree with that. It's just that my point is that if we're going to do something like this, in my opinion, and I believe the opinion of the firefighters, additional training needs to be done on these, particularly some of these financial issues and the like.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my concern is that our district attorneys are not prosecuting the cases of failure to report. There are very, very few cases where district attorneys have prosecuted someone for that, because it's not on their high priority list. So then you continue to have mandatory reporters who don't do their job. And I think your point is valid. We're adding you to another list of the mandatory reporters, but so what? What does that mean? If we're not going to give some guidance about what you need to do and where you need to learn the information in order to be the best first responder in that situation, I don't think the legislation is very good. So, you know, I'd like to hear from some of the other people who testify. I don't know who all has testified today about what they think about requiring that as part of professional development. And I think it's a serious enough issue that it doesn't require a whole day class. I mean, you get a half hour, 45 minute, or an hour presentation on what's the protocol. And maybe then we'll start having teachers and administrators, or administrators in this case, starting to report the child sex abuse, or the social worker reporting the elder abuse when they go into the home. So that's kind of my soapbox on that, which is a bill that's coming up later, but it, you know, it's relevant here. And I appreciate your concerns.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Livingston. Would subtle signs of abuse that may be obvious to a highly trained individual be less obvious to a firefighter?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think that's the question, and it's a very valid question. It's a broad brush question. As an example, as you know, unfortunately, as some of our elders, and particularly our most vulnerable age, certainly in my experience, when we respond to these types of individuals, it's not uncommon to see bruises and bruises on their bodies from just simply having an accidental fall and some of those. And so the question is I don't think it's any harder for us, but I think the environment that your firefighters and your paramedics go into when they go into the home for a call for 911 that may not be related to how they got their bruises and that kind of stuff, that's where the difficulty comes in there, because sometimes it is hard to diagnose, at least at our level, on what we're there for to treat it and what really caused the injury. Certainly we try to probe into those things, but we're certainly not in an emergency setting. It may be the first time that we've went to that house. Whereas on the other hand, somebody from Adult Protective Services, they have people that are specifically trained in there to kind of look at these other issues in that. And so I'm trying to answer your question, but yes, I think we are trained to do it, but not at the level of some of these other individuals that have really focused on elder abuse.
Precisely.
Thank you very much. I'm Senator Barr.
Thank you. Under this definition, would volunteer firefighters and volunteer emergency medical technicians be included?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that would be correct. They would fall under the definition as well.
That may be problematic.
Firefighters?
Huh?
Your question again was?
We're volunteers.
Oh. Volunteer firefighters. Yeah,
yeah, and I mean, it's hard enough to get volunteer firefighters as it is. And
well, again, I think probably some of the bills that are going to be coming up will probably have more of a bearing on that than this one probably. Thank you very much for your testimony. Could we have? Did you have something else?
Not for Bob, but for maybe Peter or something else. I've been trying to reconcile this reporting statute with the child abuse reporting statutes.
He's coming up next. So well, before we ask Mr. Shepherd and Ms. Kelly Seal, I'd like to enter into the record a letter written by Judge Claudia Burton from Marion County Circuit Court on her own behalf, and a letter in support written by Nanheim on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association, again, in support of Senate Bill 106, so we'll get those in the record. If we could have Mr. Shepherd and Ms. Kelly Seal come back for a couple of outstanding questions here, that'd be great. Maybe we could start with page 3, line 25, where you have the exclusion from an elderly person or a person with disabilities being able to file their, ostensibly, their own petition. Just give us
Madam Chair, members of the committee, page 3, lines 25 through 27.
You identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Pete Shepherd, Deputy Attorney General, and I still have a cold. So, the lines in question were added in an effort to try, as Mr. Marble described, to dovetail these proceedings with previously existing, that is to say, pending proceedings involving the same individuals that are operating under the guardianship and conservatorship statutes. The reason that concern arises is stems from the different kind of remedy that we're talking about in relation to Senate Bill 106. This is designed to be, it's modeled on the family abuse restraining order statutes. And it's designed to be a self-help remedy available to the individual and then expanded in various sessions to include guardians and guardians ad litem acting on behalf of the individuals. When a similar proposal was advanced last session, that is to say a proposal to expand these self-help restraining orders to include financial and sexual abuse, concern arose from some members of the judiciary who practice in the family court area. That's the part of the courts that, as you know, are concerned and oversee the activities of guardians and conservators. And the concern that arose was simply this. Let's hypothesize a situation in which a guardianship or a conservatorship exists because the individual in question, whose assets are being protected by operation of those judicially overseen mechanisms, let's suppose that exists because the person cannot exercise the kind of judgment that would be necessary to prevent him or herself from, let's say, a form of financial self-abuse. And so the guardian or conservator is appointed under the power of those statutes to help protect that person against that person's judgment. Now, let's suppose that we create an overlapping self-help remedy, which permits that person individually to go to court and purport to obtain an order, for example, that seems to have the authority of interdicting something that the guardian or conservator is seeking to do in the discharge of the guardian or conservator's efforts. And let's further complicate it by assuming that perhaps the guardianship or the conservatorship has been established in one county and the individual in question seeks the self-help remedy from a circuit court in another jurisdiction. And so that kind of concern about the overlap between these remedies gave rise to lines 25 through 27. I should say to the committee that this is an area of concern for advocates in this area because, unfortunately, we do have examples in the collective history of those of us who worked on these issues of guardians and conservators who were themselves the abusers. And notwithstanding the fact that those individuals trace their authority to the oversight and supervision of a court, nevertheless, we have had cases, and the Department of Justice has civilly prosecuted some such cases, in which the guardian or conservator is him or herself the abuser. So what lines 25 through 27 represent is a policy judgment to try and divide a line between those and to direct the person who is being abused by a guardian or conservator and that person's family back into the originating court rather than using the self-help remedy.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. It is very complicated. Did you have anything to add?
No, Madam Chair.
Ms. Kelsey. Thank you very much. I appreciate you doing that. Are there questions from the committee?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Byer?
On the issue of, now, is it 419D010 with the mandatory reporting statutes for child abuse? Is that the right spot?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, yes. Specifically, it's 419B005, subsection 3. And probably the one pertinent to this committee's discussion this afternoon is subsection Q, which provides that firefighters and emergency medical technicians are mandatory reporters for purposes of the child abuse reporting statute.
Further question, does that include volunteer firefighters also and volunteer emergency medical technicians?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, when I was sitting in the back of the room and heard you ask that question, I confess that I don't know the answer to that and would have to do some more work to find out.
Thank you. One more question, and this is more pertaining to current law than the changes proposed with this bill, but under K in the current bill, on page 16, lines 12 and 13, will elected officials fall under that definition of any public official who comes in contact with elderly persons in the performance of official duties? Because in the child reporting statutes, elected officials are named specifically.
Legislators are named.
Yeah, legislative assemblies are.
Mm-hmm. It's page 16, line 12. Mm-hmm. Whether we're covered under that.
Madam Chair, what I'm looking to do is to just to double check and see if public official has a does have a defined term. Public official is a defined term under 164.050 sub 5. And on the face of it, if the contact occurred in the performance of the official's official duties, then I think it would extend to an elected official.
So
that's how I would read the current law, at any rate.
I guess just for my own clarification, if I have a constituent that comes to me and complains that they or a family member has been financially abused, or because this is just dealing with financial abuse currently, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a mandatory duty to report that now under current law.
Well, if go ahead and answer that, but.
Well, I guess I would, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that if they reported to you physical abuse or neglect, that would apply, that you would have an obligation under current law to report it. The financial abuse and sexual abuse are the additions that are proposed in Senate Bill 106.
Okay, but there's no duty in this reporting to, there's no duty to investigate, is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. The duty is to report, and I should say in response to a couple of questions that were raised by the members of the committee, the duty actually is defined in 164.060, a provision of law that is not amended by the bill and thus is not reproduced in the materials that you have. But that duty provides several elements that are necessary for the reporting duty to occur, to be triggered. First, it has to be a public or private official within the definition. Then there must also be reasonable cause to believe that the form of abuse has occurred. Secondly, the reporting duty applies only to elderly persons, not to persons with disabilities, which we discussed earlier. And finally, the information must come to the reporter in the reporter's official capacity. So those are the elements of the statute. And while we were waiting our return here, I looked up the exact amount of penalty for the failure to report. It's defined by ORS 124.990 to be a Class A criminal violation, which would imply some form of action necessary by a district attorney in order to enforce it. And under ORS 153.018, the penalty is actually $600 rather than $500.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. We will hang on to this for a little bit. We will, first of all, there was some mention made earlier on about some possible changes, possible amendments that might be coming to this bill, and also the possibility of an emergency clause, which I think is a very constructive possibility. So if those folks would work with council, I appreciate it. And with that, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 106. And we will now open a... Yes?
My name's on the list.
Did you get left out? We will reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 106 because we forgot a witness. Come on up. Sometimes I don't get the sheets in a timely manner, so go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Well, for the record, I'm going to put my glasses on because I'm getting to that age. For the record, my name is Victor Hoffer. I have served on the Governor's Elder Abuse Task Force. I'm presently a member of the Attorney General's Elder Abuse Task Force. And I'm also a member of the Washington County Elder Abuse NDT. I'm an Oregon State Certified ENT Paramedic. I work presently in the field with real patients, with real things, in Washington County. I'm a senior paramedic and field training officer. I have prepared remarks, which will take about 30 seconds, and then I have, if Madam Chair and the committee would like, some answers to those hard questions you gave. That will take another minute or two, particularly Senator Walker's and Senator Byers' questions, if I may. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 106. Firefighters and EMTs respond every day to assist the community. Senate Bill 106 will allow us to do a better job. In fact, we are already reporting elder abuse. Being included as a mandatory reporter will not burden us, but it will rather protect us. Presently, when we report elder abuse, we have no protection when making a good faith report. This inclusivity that's being requested is protection, and it is not going to be a burden on us. Senate Bill 106 is about protecting the elderly. Allow firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics to do their part in protecting the elderly. Madam Chair and the committee members, you and everyone in this room will one day be elderly. Please protect those who are elderly today by the passage of Senate Bill 106.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? This witness, Senator Starr?
I believe he's indicated that he had some answers that, to previous questions that maybe were not answered.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Starr, thank you very much. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, with regards to Senator Walker's very, very excellent question about training, the easy solution is this. Department of Human Services, Emergency Medical Services, places specific training requirements on everyone. It would be easy to have them by rule, simply by rule, to put an hour of child abuse / elder abuse. Simple. Right now, as you know, the Oregon State Bar Association has mandatory child abuse reporting that you take every reporting period. I didn't tell you I'm an attorney too, so I have to go to that one. So that would be a solution. It may not be the best solution, but it's a thought. And training is available through Adult and Protective Services, as you have already heard. Multidisciplinary teams in the counties will provide that as well. If I may address two other things. One, with regards to criminal, there's a lot of discussion prior to the committee convening. What if a firefighter or paramedic misses something? Well, this is the key to this. When it's obvious, it's obvious. And that is when a criminal action may be taken, as Senator Walker has suggested. When it's not obvious, it's not obvious. With regards to volunteers, my humble opinion as a paramedic, a volunteer firefighter, a volunteer paramedic in the past, is that this says firefighters. It does not exclude anybody. It says EMTs. It does not exclude anyone. And as a volunteer firefighter, I have the same responsibilities as I do as a paid firefighter or as a paid paramedic. I would suggest right now that there are no volunteers who are going to quit being a volunteer if SB 106 passes. The people who volunteer have a commitment to their community. I had a commitment to my community. My father had a 41-year commitment to his community, getting out of bed at 3 in the morning and making me go down to the fire call with him. The volunteers have a commitment that are not concerned about Senate Bill 106. They're concerned about the community. They're concerned about the people that you represent. And Senate Bill 106 will only protect them when they do make a valid good faith report. I was asked to have examples available, if you so desire, of actual cases. That will be brief, if you so desire, Madam Chair.
I think we'll just wait. We'll wait on that. We're getting a little short on time. But thank you very much.
And may I just say, that if there is a work group, I very much would like to be part of that work group. Thank you.
I appreciate you coming. I appreciate your volunteering your services to the community. Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you. Okay, Mr. Kopp, you look very, we're about to close this hearing, so just very quickly.
Mr. Marble, I'd like to explain my comments.
Actually, I think we'll wait on that, Mr. Kopp, because we're kind of out of time. We kind of elaborated on those. But right now, unless there's somebody else in the audience that I've forgotten, speak now or forever hold your peace. We are closing the hearing on Senate Bill 106, and we will open a work session on... We're going to skip one because there's a class that's going to hopefully come in here for the hearing on Senate Bill 113. They're kind of running out of time. But we're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 262. This is the council, the OHSU Primate Center bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As I believe most of you know, Mr. O'Leary was here for the public hearing and unfortunately, due to an illness, is not available today. There are Dash 1 and Dash 4 amendments. I hope that you all have copies of those proposed amendments. The fact that there is a Dash 2 and Dash 3 leads me to believe they're somewhere out there, although they were not requested by the Judiciary Committee office, and therefore, due to privilege issues with LC, we were unable to get copies of those, so I don't know if members of the...
We have the Dash 3. I think the Dash 3 actually might have been something that was coming in from the work group, but I think the Dash 4 replaces the 3.
Yes, okay. It's my understanding that the Dash 4 amendment is what we're working on. Right. Could we have... I see Mr. Berenger back there. We're going to drag you up here, Brian, because our counsel is very ill. He may even be at OHSU as we speak. I'm just kidding.
I
don't
want
to gossip here. Please identify yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Brian Berenger, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at OHSU. Senator Prozanski is correct. It's the Dash 4 amendments that we would like you to consider today. As you recall from the hearing last week, the Dash 1 amendment and the Dash 3 amendments were the direction the committee wanted to pursue, but they did not fit together. So the Dash 4 amendment is simply an amendment that combines the ones and the threes.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee regarding the Dash 4 amendments? These are the combined amendment to separate the idea of the sunset extension from the amendment that makes it clear that this does not apply to press releases, websites, or other publications circulated to the general public, but the exclusion from the public records law.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get my brain on the language in the amendment, but on the very last page on where it references the subsection 31, it deletes that section.
Right. Senator Ringo, I think I'll take a stab at this. The way legislative council does sunsets, they basically put in the language of the bill and then they delete it effective at the end of the sunset period. So it's kind of a backwards way of accomplishing a sunset. But that's what that provision is. If you add up the italicized content and the bold content, that equals a sunset in 2010, 4-year sunset.
Italicized is law until the sunset.
That's law now. The sunset goes into effect at the beginning in January unless we do something.
Correct.
That's right. Okay.
Okay. All right. Are there other questions, Mr. Berenger?
That's right. Okay.
Okay. We have a little bit of division on the committee on this particular one. I know Senator Walker has some concerns about this whole approach, but I would like to move ahead unless I see some desperate body language from others on the committee. Senator Starr, we have an amendment before us.
Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 262. Is there a discussion?
Yes, Madam
Senator
Chair. I do want to thank you for sending this over, and I did find my file from last session. What does that say about me? But anyway, I did find the file. I reviewed it. The arguments were very similar what we had last session and again just recently, and I'm going to be a no. I understand the concerns, but we went through this at length last session, and I wasn't convinced then, and I'm not convinced now, so I'm going to be a no vote.
Appreciate that, Senator Walker. Is there other discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll on the motion to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. With one objection, the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 262 are adopted. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 262 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 262 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to vote aye at this time. I do want to reserve the right to review it in its entirety just to make certain I don't have any other issues. I know that what Senator Walker said, I think I dealt with on the House side last time. I think I'm comfortable now, but I'm going to reserve the right to maybe change my vote on the floor, but I'll let the chair know before that happens.
I appreciate that, Senator Przanski. Is there other discussion? Senator Walker?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Przanski, I'm happy to share my bill file from last session if you would like to review it, the notes.
Thank you.
And the materials.
Thank you. And at this time, I will declare a potential conflict of interest because the public relations agency I work at in my day job has OHSU as a client. Is there further discussion? Okay. Clerk, will you please call the roll again? The motion has been made to send Senate Bill 262-4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
And Chair Burdick?
Aye. Senate Bill 262, as amended, goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Ringo will carry it.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Am I the first no vote in our committee?
No, I believe when I was gone and not able to control anything, Senator Beyer cast a no vote.
Okay.
Senator Beyer cast a no vote on the dead lawyer bill.
Oh.
It was said that Senator Beyer thought that there were not enough lawyers included in the bill. So. That was a joke.
Really?
I like lawyers. Okay, well, we waited long enough for the class to appear. They have not appeared, so at this time we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 113. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 113 would change the law as currently written to extend the amount of time in between diversions. Diversion programs for persons who are arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants are available to a person who has not been convicted within the last 10 years and who has not injured another person or themselves. This or has not already gone through a diversion program in the last 10 years. This would extend that to 15 years.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And the chair has misplaced this. Oh, here it is. Sign-up sheet is right here. Okay, we will have Teresa Douglas from the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Your lead-off witness here. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Committee.
Thank you. I apologize for my croaky voice. I, too, am suffering from the same virus as many other people.
I think it's sick building syndrome, so welcome to the club.
Thank you. My name is Teresa Douglas. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm also an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist. I've been working as a DUII diversion and conviction evaluator since 1984. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 113, which does increase the waiting time for diversion eligibility from 10 years to 15 years. The diversion program was established in 1981 to divert first-time DUI offenders out of the criminal justice system and to relieve overburdened court dockets. Diversion was also an opportunity to provide early intervention treatment. Most first-time DUI clients have not had the opportunity to benefit from treatment, substance abuse treatment. The long-term goal was prevention of further alcohol abuse problems and the desire to prevent additional incidents of intoxicated driving. In exchange for completing treatment and complying with diversion requirements, diversion clients do not receive criminal penalties such as jail, court-ordered driver's license suspension, or a criminal conviction on their driving records. Diversion clients are subject to an administrative Department of Motor Vehicle suspension of their driving privileges based on their failure of the breathalyzer test or refusal to submit the intoxilizer test. One thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the diversion agreement does not require total sobriety on the client's part during the entire year that they're on diversion. They are required to remain sober during the period of time that they're in treatment, and they are required not to operate a motor vehicle in conjunction with any use of alcohol at all. But they are not subject to the total sobriety such as a conviction would be as a part of a probation requirement. Since the diversion program has been in place for approximately 24 years, it has evolved as a way for repeat DUI offenders to avoid criminal sanctions for continued intoxicated driving behavior. Attached to this testimony, you'll find a summary of current diversion clients that are on my caseload currently and that have had previous DUI offenses. Many have had at least one opportunity to benefit from a treatment program. In some cases, the offenders had several opportunities to benefit from treatment. This is but a small sampling of a large number of repeat offenders that are currently enrolled in the diversion program on my caseload. My staff went through probably since about May to the current date, and they pulled at least 50 cases of people that have had prior DUIs and are currently on diversion. By allowing repeat DUI offenders to access the diversion program more than one time, we are allowing these offenders to avoid criminal sanctions and receive the same privileges that a first-time offender receives. If we wish to deter repeat intoxicated driving behavior, consequences for that behavior are crucial. Therefore, we would ask that this legislation be passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Did you consider other time periods besides 15 years? How did you settle on 15 years?
I believe there is some another bill that addresses that, Madam Chair.
Is what?
That addresses a longer time period than the 15 years.
No, but I'm talking about your
process. Bill itself.
Yeah, why you've settled on 15 rather than, you know, 20 or some other time period.
I believe part of it was due to record keeping, and part of it was due to the criminal sanction time period is 15 years, and I believe that was our consideration. Also, we had another bill that asked for a lower BAC for repeat offenders that have had another offense within 15 years, so this tied into that same time period.
Mm. Okay, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, ma'am, I was wondering on the, it might just be a little off the subject, but in the enforcement of these DUI situations, wouldn't the increased use of the of ignition key locks, breathalyzers, be a lot more efficient in rather than increasing sanctions, increased detection?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the ignition interlock device, I believe that's what you're asking about. That is in place right now for DUI convictions. It is not for DUI diversions. They're not required to do the ignition interlock to have a hardship license.
And then, can you explain why they're not, if they're very effective?
I'm sorry, I don't have expertise with the ignition interlock device, Senator.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Hi, thank you. And I'm sorry, I had a side conversation, so I missed part of your testimony, so I'm sorry if it duplicates.
Chair Burdick asked, I mean, what? Why 15 years? And you weren't sure about that. And you've attached on the last page of case summaries where people have reoffended after that 10-year period. To me, that's not convincing. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, maybe the 10-year period, the success stories are 100 or hundreds long. I mean, what's the evidence that going from 10 to 15 will make a difference?
Madam Chair, Senator Rango, I don't think there's any magic number. I will say that you won't see any examples in there of people that have had other DUIs within 10 years because they're not eligible to have diversion, and we screen those out very, very efficiently. The 15 years, I believe, was because of the other bill that the Governor's Advisory Committee had in regarding lowering the BAC on repeat offenders. And making that a 15-year time period. So I believe that was the reason for the 15 years.
What's the track record of these people in diversion actually abiding by the no driving requirements?
Madam Chair, Senator Rango, I would say I don't have statistics regarding their driving without a license. I would say from my own personal experience as an evaluator that I probably see 15 to 20% that get new driving under the influences while they're on diversion.
Uh-huh. I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there on the road with suspended licenses. And I'm just wondering, is this bill going to make any difference, or is it going to make people that are making an honest effort to clean up their act and people that have cleaned up their act, it's going to make it 5 years longer before they can really get back and integrate into society?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rango, I believe that, you know, if our focus is to get people to stop this behavior, that we have to stop giving them a way out of the sanctions for repeating that behavior, be it 10 or 15 or 20 years, that they are just as dangerous 15 years down the road as they were the first time they did it.
Follow up, Madam Chair? Yeah, but to me the assumption behind that is that, okay, that you're apparently dealing with somebody that has complied with the diversion for 10 years and has said, okay, I'm not going to drive because it's against the law, but year 11, great, now I can drive, and not I'm only going to drive, I'm going to drive and drink. And I just suggest that kind of behavior, you're not going to impact that behavior through this legislation.
Our council has a comment on that, Senator Rango.
Senator Rango, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rango, if a person participates in diversion, the diversion program is only a year-long program,
okay.
So they would have driving privileges.
I see.
During that 10-year period of
I
time
see.
Or 15-year period
I'm
of time.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
To clarify that issue.
It's
good to be clarified. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We will now take Kelly Skye. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose Senate Bill 113 and really any further efforts to continue to restrict the diversion program in Oregon. I think that Senator Rango began to reflect some of the concerns that we have, and that is that that the list of people that's provided, I think it's five or six people, that these are, this number is representative of a failure of something that's in the law. Likewise, I'm not so convinced that this represents a failure. It actually is a very limited number. And every session, we come back to the diversion laws and to the drunk driving laws, and there are still people drinking and driving, and we continue to increase the penalties, and we continue to spend more and more money on prosecuting in this area, when at the other end, we're dropping people from the Oregon Health Plan so that they don't have access to free alcohol treatment. So we oppose this bill primarily in policy, in that we would like to see a focus on access to treatment for folks and not continuing to restrict the avenues for treatment that we have, diversion being one of them. And I would point out that forgive me for forgetting the woman who testified here earlier, but you know, she said that the diversion program was established in 1981, and one of its purposes was to relieve the overburdened criminal dockets. Well, that is a problem that's gotten significantly worse, not better, since 1981. In this day and age, we, you know, you're all familiar with the fact that we cannot keep up with prosecuting offenses. We can't keep our courts funded. We can't keep indigent defense funded, and the DA's offices are struggling under their burdens. Since 1981, we have altered the diversion statute in very significant ways. The most significant way is that it now requires a guilty or no contest plea. So no longer is diversion what it was in 1981, where you got to go in without making an admission and you got to preserve your right to a trial going into diversion. Now you are required to waive your right to a trial in order to go into diversion. So it's not the free lunch that it was, that it's seen to be by many folks. It requires that plea, you waive your right to a trial. If you fail in diversion, you are convicted and sentenced. So, you know, in light of that, unless we can really determine that this is going to fix it, it could cost more money because these people are people who don't get into diversion will more likely litigate on a second DUI. And it's not clear that spending the money in this way will actually help to keep drinking and driving or help to limit it.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out mostly for the benefit of Senator Witsit, because he was not here last session, that we did we not make that change in the diversion program requiring the guilty plea up front or no contest plea. Isn't that true, Ms. Guy?
Correct. That was a last session.
Okay. Just wanted to give some point of reference for our new
Thank comment. You very much. Any other questions? Thank you. We will now take Kamala Sugar, who I hope I pronounced your name correctly this time, and Bruce Pratt and Ann Pratt. The Lane County delegation is here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You can fight over the order.
I've been elected to go first.
Okay, great.
Kamala Sugar from the Lane County District Attorney's Office, and here as a representative of the Oregon District Attorney's Association Legislative Committee. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony this afternoon. In Oregon and across the nation, the DUI diversion is a privilege and not a right. Currently, it's a privilege that people enjoy once every 10 years. There are many cases that I've reviewed personally as a prosecutor in which a person is just outside that 10-year period when they reoffend. We actually comment on it to each other routinely in our office. Wow, he just missed the 10-year mark and he gets a diversion. One of the questions or concerns raised by the OCDLA, by Ms. Skye, is the cost of prosecution versus the resources placed into treatment. I think it's important to point out that both a DUII diversion case and a DUII case that goes to a criminal prosecution involve the time and efforts of either a state police trooper, a deputy sheriff, or a police officer in investigating the case. They require the retention of evidence. They require the review of a criminal prosecutor. They require the court to still have a hearing. The defendant still has to appear, and the offender is still ordered to do
alcohol treatment. They also all still include a driver's license suspension of 90 days, not a year, as was earlier stated. The only difference is whether the case actually goes and is litigated as a trial. And in most of the DUI cases, they are not litigated as a trial. There's a motion to suppress that lasts less than a day, and the offenders either pleads guilty, and in rare circumstances, they go to trial. So the cost difference is not the issue in deciding whether a person should be entitled to a diversion after 10 years or 15 years. Instead, I would argue the question is the purpose of diversion. The purpose of diversion is to allow treatment and rehabilitation without creating a criminal conviction or crippling insurance rates for an offender. Ultimately, our goal, both I believe the goal of elected officials and of prosecutors and of members of Crime Victims United here, is to protect the people on the streets from repeat DUI drivers. It is correct. A person who has enjoyed the privilege of a diversion has a 90-day driver's license suspension, 1-year obligation to complete treatment and pay fines. And after that, for the next 9 years, they can live their life as they choose. They can continue to consume alcohol as long as they don't drive. What we find is that people do relapse. And the question is whether the person should be charged with DUI and convicted so that there's a record of their behavior and there's some accountability, or whether they should have another bite at the apple. That bite at the apple includes increasing the risk of the safety of drivers on the street. I also wanted to point out that if Senator Ringo, Chair Burdick and Senator Ringo, if members of the committee are concerned with whether people abide by requirements regarding driving while suspended, we could get statistics regarding convictions for driving while suspended infractions and collate those with people who've enjoyed a diversion. That might be available through the DMV if we wanted to get that information. I also wanted to address this question regarding the ignition interlock device, which is a legitimate question. And that, I would say, diversion, again, does not require sobriety. It only lasts 1 year, and the suspension is only 90 days. However, so the ability to require an ignition interlock device would only be for that 90-day period. It would not be for 10 years. And the court, however, when someone's convicted of a DUI, would then have the ability to require that device for the period of the driver's license suspension, which could be up to a year or 3 years, depending on the number of prior convictions. So the value of a conviction after a person has had a diversion in their, on their record is that there's a record that they committed the crime. There's a, some more restrictions on their use of alcohol in conjunction with use of a motor vehicle. I've heard a lot of judges say you may only drive and operate a motor vehicle after 8 hours after consuming an intoxicant. And that kind of restriction is not available when someone's on a diversion. Furthermore, the access to treatment remains the same, and I think that's an important point. I have one anecdote, and then I'll turn the floor over.
We're running out of time, and I want to make sure they at least get to talk for 2 minutes.
All right. Well, I can save that if the chair would
maybe
prefer.
Maybe that would be good.
Okay.
Yeah. So why don't we hear from you, Ms. Brett?
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll try not to be lengthy here. I am a member of Crime Victims United.
Could you identify yourself for the record? Would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I'm also a Madeline County board member. And I'm also a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. And as a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee, I wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 113. But today I'm testifying on behalf of Crime Victims United. And while we agree the years could be lengthened between diversion opportunities we would like to offer. We have a bill, 625, that is a once-in-a-lifetime diversion opportunity, and we would like to offer that as an amendment, a possible amendment to Senate Bill 113, just taking it one step farther. There's other diversion opportunities available in the state of Oregon for other crimes, for instance, domestic violence and drug crimes, and they only have a one-time opportunity. And I'm not certain why we allow these people who endanger our lives on a daily basis to have more than one chance. I've often heard it said by OSP that one out of 12 on our roadways today are impaired. And for someone who's already lost a family member to an impaired driver, that's far from acceptable. About one-third of the drivers that are arrested or convicted are repeat offenders, and they're 40% more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than those without prior DUIs. These are actually the cases that I've collected since the last session, and they are cases of repeat offenders that have resulted in manslaughters or criminal harm or assaults.
Thank you, and those will be made a part of the public record.
Okay. Our diversion agreement, in DMV, we should be talking about 15 people that this once in a life, for every 10 years that this would affect. But the truth is we have other offenders in there who their DUIs have been within 10 years, and there's some in there who have been, their DUIs are as close as 5 years. So we have a system that is also has been taken advantage of. And I guess what I want to say is, why are we enabling these repeat offenders to continue to be considered as first-time offenders? And how many bites of that apple do they get? There are other diversion programs in other states, and they're often referred to as probation before judgment programs. And a study in Maryland was done, and I'll try and make it short. The results were that the more times a person was diverted, the higher the recidivism rate. And those with the lowest recidivism rate were those charged and convicted of each offense. The first-time offenders, 11% were less, 11% reoffended that were diverted. Those that were convicted, only 8% reoffended. It's really very close, but as it moves into the second, we have 29% that reoffended that were diverted, and 16% that were convicted twice. The third time, of three offenders, 52% that were diverted twice reoffended, and only 32% of those convicted all three times reoffended. NHTSA also did a similar study and came up with a similar conclusion. And this also, we believe, undermines the repeat offender status. And let's not forget the tragic happening in Portland 2 years ago on Belmont Street, where two cyclists were killed. That drunk driver was a repeat offender. He had been previously in diversion, and he was in a diversion program when he struck down two cyclists and critically injured a third. He did get 20 years in prison. He had a very high VAC. I'm not positive of what they are, what it was, excuse me. But the cyclists in that incident, in that tragic incident, got death. In conclusion, I would like to say I'm in favor of diversion, but I would like to see it a one-time opportunity. I would like to hit them harder and do a better job, perhaps in treating them and holding them accountable. just make it count. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. And because we are out of time, you have been the spokesman for Bruce Pratt, Cecilia Carey, and Marie Armstrong, who are also here for Crime Victims United. And I apologize that we ran out of time. Would have liked to hear from all of you. The other witness who got left out was Troy Costellas from the Department of Transportation, and I presume we can have a conversation at some point on those concerns. So I appreciate your coming, and apologize for running out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The hearing on Senate Bill 113 is closed, and Senate Judiciary is adjourned.